right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Donating your car or boats is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
Yo, this is your brother Speech from the crew Arrested Development. You rocking with KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
It's Friday, September 4th. I'm Scott Baba. The United Nations votes to adopt a more accurate world map.
Correcting the map means choosing fidelity to the fact. It means recognizing that every region of the world deserves to be represented accurately and with dignity.
North Carolina is the first state to begin sending out ballots for this year's midterm elections.
Our counties are ready. I want to emphasize this point because there's been a lot of questions about that. Our county workers are ready.
And an Arizona border town sheriff calls foul on Trump's xenophobic rhetoric, saying his town has lower crime rates than neighboring communities and that his family's own land is being impacted for the proposed border wall.
Because there's so much sensationalism at the national level related to borders and immigration and very little truth on that subject. You know, for example, the statistics are wildly skewed. They will claim that people, you know, immigrants, migrants are coming here to commit crimes, to murder, to rape, to plunder, to steal. That's Donald Trump's own words, but the truth couldn't be farther from that.
These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacific Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on a Turkish financial institution as part of its latest effort to sever critical financial lifelines for the Iranian government. The actions today against Golden Global Yatrim Benkasi Anonim Serketi come after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent launched Operation Economic Outcast. It's the new administration effort to isolate already heavily sanctioned Iran from its remaining trading partners to try and get it to capitulate to U.S. demands after more than 6 months of war. The U.S. also targeted an Egyptian bank's operations in the United Arab Emirates last week. South Korea is reviewing possible military measures to help keep the Strait of Hormuz open, but officials say no decision has been made. The South Korean presidential office said options include a maritime patrol aircraft, a logistics support ship, or a mine-clearing unit. The review comes after President Donald Trump ordered the Pentagon last month to substantially reduce joint military exercises with South Korea. Trump said South Korea had refused to help the United States in its war with Iran and cited that refusal as one of the reasons for scaling back the drills. The annual exercises involved about 18,000 South Korean troops. South Korea is now discussing possible contributions with the United States, Britain, and France. South Korean media reported that Seoul was preparing to deploy military assets by the end of the year, But any overseas military deployment would require approval from South Korea's National Assembly. Seoul said it must also consider military readiness on the Korean Peninsula. The strait is critical to South Korea's economy. Last year, 61% of its crude oil imports passed through the waterway. South Korean President Lee Jae-myung may discuss the issue with French President Emmanuel Macron next week. Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has laid out a plan for the forced expulsion of all Palestinians from Gaza, aiming to remove 250,000 people in the first year and the remaining roughly 2 million over 6 years. Ben-Gvir called the plan, quote, realistic, claiming unnamed countries are ready to accept displaced Palestinians. He said the proposal was the result of over a year of work and that his party would demand a, quote, ministry in charge of emigration in the next government. The forced displacement of civilians from occupied territory is considered a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. Despite the plan's title referring to, quote, voluntary emigration, it's expected to be seen internationally as coercive, given dire conditions in Gaza and Ben-Gvir's explicit goal of removing the population entirely. His statements were translated by ATP News.
Our plan is a practical plan, a professional plan, a work plan that we promise to implement in the next term. The legal conclusion by all the legal advisors, the right to leave Gaza, exists. But there is no automatic right to enter. So it is clear that this is a free choice. We are not forcing the departure, but yes, it is encouraged. There are masses who want to pass. We need to allow them the correct transition, to take care of them in the country that we want them to emigrate to, for housing, for education, for health. It is possible. I am telling you.
The proposal follows similar comments from Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz, who said Israel is seeking Trump administration approval to facilitate Palestinian displacement, quote, by any means. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this week Israel won't withdraw from Gaza, saying, we control the area. We are not retreating. We are staying on this line. We control 60% of the strip, and we are not stopping because we are eliminating the terrorists who threaten us, doing so day in and day out. Israeli officials say the country now controls 65% of Gaza, well beyond the 53% outlined in last year's ceasefire agreement. Israel's forcible displacement of Palestinians from three West Bank refugee camps violated international law, according to a new report from the United Nations Human Rights Office. More than 33,000 Palestinians were expelled from camps and operations in early 2025. The report says Israel continues to prevent the displaced residents from returning to the three camps. All this as conditions continue to deteriorate in the occupied territory, with school closures and the uprooting of olive trees in recent days. Christopher Martinez reports.
The new report from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says the large-scale, long-term, and systematic displacement of more than 33,000 Palestinians raises serious concerns of the crime against humanity of forcible transfer. Tamin Alt-Kitan is a spokesperson for the Human Rights Office.
Forcing the displacement of their residents and preventing their return appear to amount to collective punishment and raise concerns of ethnic cleansing.
The displacements in question involve camps in the West Bank villages of Jenin, Nur Shams, and Tulkarm in January and February of last year. Al-Kitan describes the operations.
Israeli forces went door to door, forcing residents to leave the Jenin, Nur Shams, and Tulkarm refugee camps. They killed civilians, destroyed hundreds of homes, damaged roads and other infrastructure, and cut off water and electricity. Some of the Palestinians displaced told us that Israeli officers informed them there would be no more refugee camps and that they should, quote unquote, all go to Jordan.
Those displacements were not isolated incidents, but rather part of a larger and ongoing pattern, including recurrent attacks by Israeli settlers, sometimes with the apparent participation of Israeli military. René Dujarric is a spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
Turning to the West Bank, our humanitarian colleagues there tell us that since 2023, more than 6,400 Palestinians have been displaced in 130 communities by settler violence. Of those displaced, more than 25,000 people were forced out this year alone, more than half of them children. That has left 48 Palestinian communities fully displaced since 2023, including a dozen just this year.
Other recent actions in the West Bank include the removal of olive trees by Israeli army bulldozers just weeks before the October harvest season. The Israeli military said the uprooting was carried out for military operational needs. Khalil Al-Fari is one of the olive tree landowners.
The olive trees were planted with our blood and sweat. These olives, this one and that one, belong to my brother. My brother is an expatriate. He went abroad, worked hard, and bought them. And this old woman, who is their mother, may God have mercy on her, brought water, carrying it on her head, and planted them, nurturing them for 30 years. Then the Israeli occupation comes in 5 minutes and uproots all the olive trees. What did they do to them? What did we do? What sin did the olive tree commit?
Earlier this week, the UN World Food Programme said it's slashing its food assistance in the West Bank, starting this month. Claire Neville is a spokesperson for WFP in Palestine.
And all of this pressure has been building in terms of the economic downturn, coupled with increasing settler violence and incursions on land, people sort of losing access to their livestock and agricultural land, which has also now had an impact on people's food security. So just as the situation is getting worse and we should be scaling up to meet these needs, we're unfortunately having to scale back and effectively halve the amount of people that we can reach because of the lack of funding.
The WFP estimates that some 900,000 Palestinians in the West Bank are food insecure. One of them is Intirar Khalid Hussein Awad, a displaced mother of four.
We no longer have the source of income to buy everything our children need. As for fruit, I no longer buy them. Vegetables, I can't get them. All my children used to eat 3 or 4 meals a day. Now I can only secure for them 2 meals, the most important only.
About 2.8 million Palestinians live under Israeli military rule in the West Bank, alongside about 560,000 Israeli settlers. President Donald Trump has said he opposes Israeli annexation of the West Bank, but he's also signaled acceptance of settlements. And at the start of his second term, he lifted sanctions on settlers accused of violence. But earlier this week, U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee spoke out after a Palestinian American was besieged in his home by Israeli settlers. Huckabee spoke to Israel's Channel 11 Tuesday.
When you engage in activity that is intended to change the behavior and to create fear in an individual, an entire society, or a community, that is the definition, the historic dictionary definition of terror. So I don't know what else to call it.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The United Nations General Assembly voted today to endorse a new world map projection that more accurately shows the size of Africa and other bodies, replacing the centuries-old Mercator map, long criticized for shrinking regions near the equator and expanding the perceived size of land masses closer to the poles. The resolution favoring the equal Earth projection passed with 164 votes in favor, with 6 abstentions. The United States was the only country to vote against it. U.S. Representative Yarina Farenovich read a statement which dismissed the resolution as ideologically charged and a waste of the United Nations' time.
While this initiative is presented as an anodyne effort to update cartographic proportions, the United States clearly sees it cannot be separated from the much larger and more radical ideological project it belongs to, as its most vocal and committed proponents plainly and openly state. Instead of focusing on genuine problems of international peace, prosperity, or good relations, this body is debating map projects from the 16th century and their role in promoting reparations and cognitive justice. Resolutions like this one and the ideological agenda they promote are barnacles on our work here and the reason this institution is losing its credibility.
The Mercator projection, created in 1569 to aid sailors, preserves compass directions but distorts landmass size, making Greenland appear as large as Africa, though it's actually about 1/14 the size. Critics say this has reinforced a Eurocentric worldview that shrinks equatorial, often developing nations, while enlarging wealthier northern ones. Togo's Foreign Minister Robert Dussy, who sponsored the resolution on behalf of the African Union, spoke before the UN General Assembly ahead of the vote.
Maps are not simply geographical tools. Maps shape our understanding of the world. They guide education, nourish the imagination, and influence collective perceptions. They are therefore never neutral. When they present a distorted image of our planet, they risk perpetuating inaccurate representation that are passed down through generation.
For that reason, Dussy said,
correcting the map means choosing fidelity to the fact. It means recognizing that every region of the world deserves to be represented accurately and with dignity. It means transmitting to future generations a fairer, more balanced, and more realistic image of the world.
Today's resolution isn't binding, but calls on member states to update educational materials and urges digital map providers to adopt more accurate representations. Google already shifted to a globe view when zoomed out in 2018. A Russian drone struck the headquarters of Ukraine's security service in central Kyiv today, wounding 12 people, just as U.S. officials prepared to travel to Moscow and Kyiv for renewed peace talks. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said, quote, the drone was deliberately targeted at the head of the SBU's office in that building. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha called the strike a, quote, major escalation, saying Moscow launched the strike during a renewed push for peace, laying bare its true rejection of diplomacy. President Donald Trump confirmed envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner will travel to Moscow and then Kyiv over the weekend, marking their first visit to the Ukrainian capital, saying, quote, they are bringing with them a proposal to end the war. Zelensky said Ukraine will pause airstrikes during the talks and called on Russia to do the same, saying, quote, we are concerned about their safety, not about Russia. President Donald Trump is threatening to stop trading with countries that run a trade surplus with the United States unless the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates. Trump made the threat today in a post on Truth Social, writing, quote, lower the rate or I'll stop trading with countries with which we have a deficit, which the U.S. Supreme Court, in its ridiculous and very costly tariff decision, strongly acknowledged the president has an absolute right to do. It's better than tariffs. The Fed board with its great new leader must get smart. Be patriots for a change. High interest rates put the USA at a very unfair disadvantage, and I won't allow that to happen. The threat came after a stronger-than-expected jobs report. According to the Labor Department, U.S. employers added 162,000 jobs in August, while the unemployment rate held at 4.1%. The report increased expectations that the Fed could raise rates at its September meeting. Last week, Fed Chairman Kevin Warsh, who Trump handpicked to replace Jerome Powell after repeatedly pressuring the former chair to cut interest rates, signaled that he is open to raising rates if inflation remains too high. A trade deficit occurs when a country imports more than it exports. The United States ran a trade deficit with many major partners last year, including China, Mexico, and Vietnam. The Fed declined to comment on Trump's threat. A federal judge has extended her block on the Postal Service implementing President Trump's executive order limiting mail voting, just as the first states began sending out midterm ballots. United States District Judge Indira Talwani, who was appointed by President Barack Obama, issued a preliminary injunction replacing her earlier temporary order, writing, quote, "Plaintiff states are required under state law to mail millions of ballots to voters on a prescribed time frame. As detailed below, they are unable to pivot this late in the election cycle, nearly guaranteeing significant disenfranchisement for eligible voters." North Carolina began sending mail ballots today, with more states set to follow soon. Nearly a third of Americans cast ballots by mail, and election officials say there isn't enough time to comply with new federal rules. So far, no state has voluntarily adopted the Postal Service's new system, which remain optional under the ruling. The Trump administration has already asked the Supreme Court to lift Talwani's earlier order and is expected to appeal this ruling as well. The High Court previously overturned Talwani's initial injunction on procedural grounds without ruling on the underlying legality of Trump's order. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has allowed political campaign committees to buy television advertising at discounted rates ahead of the November midterm elections. The court's order effectively restores Federal Communication Commission guidance that extended the lowest ad rate previously reserved for candidates to political party committees buying ads coordinated with candidates. While the rule applies to both parties, it is widely seen to benefit Republicans, who generally raise more money through party committees than Democrats. The decision came in an emergency appeal from the National Republican Congressional Committee and National Republican Senatorial Committee, supported by the Trump administration. Four Democratic candidates, including Senator John Ossoff of Georgia and former Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, had challenged the FCC policy. A federal appeals court previously ruled that federal law limited the discount to candidates only. The Supreme Court said that challenge was premature and that losing access to the discount could harm the Republican group's First Amendment rights in the weeks before the election. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson dissented. The discounted rates take effect September 4th, 60 days before the November general election. The White House today touted the latest government job numbers, showing that U.S. employers added a surprising 162,000 jobs in August. The unemployment rate stayed at 4.1%. Revisions added 55,000 jobs to June and July payrolls. The Labor Department issued the report, which could be good news for President Trump 2 months before midterm elections, in which the health of the economy is weighing on voters' minds. Max Pringle has more.
Hiring far exceeded the 65,000 forecasters had expected. Labor Department revisions also looked good. The revisions added 55,000 to June and July payrolls. Employers created 21,000 jobs in July. The Labor Department had originally reported that they'd cut 23,000. Speaking with reporters today outside the White House, National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett said President Trump's policies are creating jobs.
President Trump's economy and his policies have created now over 1 million jobs. So we went over the 1 million job mark because of this report. And if you go down into the details, you can see why. It's people, because of the tariffs, are onshoring production. We have almost 90,000 people building factories right now, which is an unheard of number.
As for the type of work people are finding, many of the jobs are in lower paying industries like home health care and restaurants. Surprisingly, 59,000 people were hired for work in bars and restaurants in August. Democrats have said the jobs numbers can't disguise the fact that the cost of living is hitting many Americans hard. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries spoke with reporters Thursday.
Under Donald Trump and Republican control of government, costs in the United States of America haven't gone down, they've gone up. Life has gotten far too expensive in this country, and Republicans don't give a damn.
Jeffries says President Trump's big, beautiful tax cut and spending bill was a giveaway to Republicans' wealthy donors.
The Republican priorities, as evidenced by the one big ugly bill in the entire Congress, has been focused on ripping health care away from the American people, enacting the largest cut to nutritional assistance in American history, literally stealing food from the mouths of seniors, hungry children, and veterans.
National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett said wages have also been rising under Trump.
The people that are seeing their salaries go up so far this year, up 4%, they're feeling the benefit. And surveys sometimes don't catch up with the sentiment of the American people and tend very often to favor Democrats.
However, according to USA Facts, wages rose about 3.6% over the past year, while inflation ran at about 3.8%. Nevada Democratic Congressman Stephen Horsford addressed that issue in a Democratic shadow hearing on the economy in Las Vegas recently.
Everything is going up at a time when the wages are not and people are working harder. That is why Trump's economy really has been what we call a Trump slump.
The latest jobs report could give the Federal Reserve leeway to raise its benchmark short-term interest rate to fight inflation. The Federal Reserve Board meets again in Washington later this month. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
North Carolina begins mailing absentee ballots today for the November midterms, even as elections officials and state leaders remain divided over new voting rules and federal changes to the mail-in ballot process. Teresa Wersbianska has more.
North Carolina is the first state in the country to begin sending absentee ballots for the 2026 midterm election. The state's 100 county boards of election are starting that process on Friday, sending ballots to voters who have requested them. Sam Hayes is the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections.
Our counties are ready. I want to emphasize this point because there's been a lot of questions about that. Our county workers are ready. They've received adequate guidance and support from the state board. Our staff have been working with the counties throughout the preparation stages, and we've begun the necessary, the necessary resources to assist the counties as questions or issues arise.
But the start of mail voting comes amid two separate fights over election rules. One, Governor Josh Stein has objected to new rules approved by the State Board of Elections. Stein says the changes come too close to the election and could create confusion for voters and election workers. One of the rules would change how county election boards handle certain absentee ballots with problems. Two other proposed rules would change how boards handle voter ID exceptions. Currently, if a voter cannot provide photo ID but claims an exception, it takes a unanimous vote of the county board to reject that exception and discard the ballot. The proposed rule would allow a simple majority to make that decision. Stein said that could allow ballot rejections to break down along party lines and undermine voters' confidence. But the rules have already been delayed for legislative review after at least 10 objections were filed. And that means they will not take effect in their original form before this year's election. There's also a federal court fight over new U.S. Postal Service rules ordered by the Trump administration. The rules would require states to provide the Postal Service with information about people receiving mail-in ballots and would require new identifying barcodes on ballot envelopes. A federal judge has blocked the rules, and the administration is asking the Supreme Court to allow them to take effect. Hayes says North Carolina is monitoring that case closely.
We are also closely monitoring legal developments involving the U.S. Postal Service and the absentee ballot mail rule. As of Wednesday, September 2nd, the judge in the combined federal case denied a motion to lift the temporary restraining order pending appeal. The court scheduled a hearing for 9 a.m. today, Thursday, September 3rd, regarding the preliminary injunction. The Department of Justice has also filed an emergency motion seeking a stay of the injunction pending appeal, with filings due today. North Carolina was already compliant
with best practices the Postal Service is trying to codify through their rules. We are also aware that the Postal Service whistleblower disclosure to Congress concerning technical implementation of the ballot mail portal. We have not independently reviewed the system or received anything in writing from the Postal Service regarding implementation.
For now, the state is moving ahead with its own absentee ballot process. Voters who requested a mail ballot could begin receiving them. The deadline to request an absentee ballot is October 20th. Early in-person voting begins October 15th, and Election Day is November 3rd. Hayes emphasized that absentee ballots must be received by the County Board of Elections by 7:30 p.m. on Election Day, not merely postmarked by that deadline. North Carolina's mail-in voting process is therefore getting underway even as election officials and courts continue to sort out which rules will govern the ballots on their journey from voter to election office. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I'm Teresa Wiersbianska.
I'm Scott Baba. You're listening to the Pacifica Evening News. It's a one-hour broadcast every weeknight. We'll be back with more after this.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we have something special down here at Birdland this evening. A recording of
KPFK. KPFK invites you to join us on air or online at 7 p.m. on the first Friday of the month for the insightful interview series Profiles with Maggie LaPeak. That's the first Friday of each month from 7 to 8 p.m. Right here on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and online for the world at kpfk.org.
This is Saul Williams, and I'm a proud supporter of KPFK because it supports our community.
Governor Gavin Newsom has until the end of the month to act on more than 800 bills sent to him by state lawmakers this week, including several dealing with wildfires and clean energy. KPFA's Eileen Alfandari has more.
The California legislative session wrapped up earlier this week, but lawmakers could be back for a special session this fall to deal with the perennial issue of who should pay when the state's large investor-owned electric utilities cause deadly and devastating wildfires. Governor Gavin Newsom unsuccessfully tried to broker a deal with lawmakers aimed at further protecting utilities from financial liability when their equipment sparks a wildfire. His push came as Southern California Edison faces claims from the state's second most destructive blaze. The 2025 Eaton Fire killed 19 people and damaged or destroyed 9,400 businesses and homes in Altadena outside of Los Angeles. Investigators recently ruled it was sparked by one of the company's transmission towers. But fire survivors and consumer groups pushed back, saying Newsom's plan would have prioritized utilities' financial concerns over the needs of survivors. Insurance companies also opposed the plan, worrying they would be stuck with more of the bill for property damage. Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas said lawmakers would revisit the issue this fall. Governor Newsom said he'll be ready to work on the issue until his term is up in January.
We've got work to do. I'm here through January, and we'll see how the process unfolds. It's just not an issue that's going away.
Lawmakers did pass another wildfire-related bill. Assemblymember John Harbedian of Pasadena told a committee hearing this spring that his legislation would create the country's first scientific testing standards for when it's safe for a resident to go back home to a house that has suffered wildfire smoke damage. Many of his constituents have battled their insurance companies over the cleanup of their homes after last year's Eaton Fire.
Individuals who have had remediation done have moved back into their homes. Testing has been done, and lead and asbestos have been upwards of 60 times the rate that are safe for humans to live in. And the problem is that there's no certainty. And what we want is experts, scientists actually making those determinations, full stop.
Lawmakers overwhelmingly approved one of the priority bills of solar energy advocates. San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener's bill would allow consumers to buy and plug in small-scale solar devices that could save them hundreds of dollars a year in electricity bills. Assemblymember Lori Davis urged support for the bill, which ended up with a unanimous vote in the state assembly.
Plug-in solar devices can save people anywhere from $200 to $800 per year, depending on the size. They can be set up by consumers in less than an hour without the need of contractors or building modifications. Eight other states have already legalized this technology, and Germany already has 4 million balcony solar systems. California needs to catch up.
But there's a catch. Only balcony solar kits approved by a national safety standards group could be installed, and that group hasn't certified any of the kits yet. The California bill is more restrictive than legislation already approved in several other states. Some California homeowners and tenants aren't waiting for final approval before buying and installing the solar devices. Finally, on the issue of privately operated immigrant detention centers in California, lawmakers approved San Francisco Assemblymember Matt Haney's bill to impose a special 25% tax on gross income of the private operators. State Senator Lena Gonzalez presented the bill before the final vote, sending it to Governor Newsom.
Private companies continue to make hundreds of millions of dollars every year off detaining Californians and separating California families and children. AB 1633 is rooted in a simple principle. Private corporations should not be able to profit from detention of children and families in California and should be held accountable for the harm caused to these families and communities. Revenue generated by the bill will be deposited into the Due Process for All Fund and, upon appropriation by the legislature, used for immigration-related services.
California has 8 immigrant detention centers holding an estimated 6,000 people, often in squalid conditions, without adequate food or medical care. 6 immigrants are known to have died in California detention facilities in the past year. I'm Eileen Alfandary for KPFA News.
A member of the San Francisco Sheriff's Oversight Board has been accused of predatory behavior, sexual assault, and violence against women since his appointment to the board overseeing law enforcement and the county jail. William Palmer has been incarcerated there at least twice and still remains on the Sheriff's Oversight Board. We want to let listeners know this next story includes accusations of rape and sexual assault. KPFA's Christina Onestad reports.
There's a growing list of women accusing William Palmer II of sexual assault and or battery. At least 5, according to reports. Yet, he's remained president of the San Francisco Sheriff's Oversight Board until today, when new positions were voted in and Palmer was not reelected.
Very challenging time in my life today, this part, on so many levels that no one could ever imagine. Being evicted from your home, being scammed out of $500,000, having your character run through the mud.
He's still serving on the board, despite the allegations against him. Palmer's downfall came about over years of accusations. The latest? Sexual coercion, which he denies, and drug use in his home, which he admits, according to an investigation by the Chronicle. Palmer told the publication he was trying to help a 26-year-old drug user with a history of psychiatric illness, though he did admit to allowing his friend to use fentanyl with a 26-year-old in his home. While a law enforcement investigation is ongoing, Palmer continues to oversee county jails he keeps finding himself inside of. Palmer began his service on the Sheriff's Oversight Board in 2021. 2 years later, in 2023, he was charged with sexually and physically assaulting a woman who accepted his offer of a ride to a BART station. The charges included sodomy and false imprisonment, according to KTVU's reporting at the time. But District Attorney Brooke Jenkins' office dropped the charges, the Chronicle reports, finding concerns with the victim's credibility. Since then, William Palmer II has faced allegations of either sexual assault or battery against women each year. In 2024, he was arrested again on suspicion of false imprisonment and domestic battery. A Sonoma County judge issued a restraining order against him to stay away from his then-ex-girlfriend and her family, according to a report by the California Post. That's an arm of the New York Post. Then last year in 2025, Palmer again faced charges of domestic battery and false imprisonment, according to the Chronicle. That case dropped for lack of evidence by San Francisco's District Attorney's Office. This year he's under the gun again with accusations of sexual coercion, a claim he denies. After the Chronicle's investigation went public, San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins released a public statement last week on social media, without naming anyone, but addressing why her office doesn't always charge everyone who's arrested.
That is because the standard by law for the police to arrest someone is probable cause. But we as prosecutors have a different and much higher standard for charging someone with a crime, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So there are moments when they present a case to us, we review it. And while we believe that we may get to the point where we can charge someone, we need them to undertake further investigation. While I know that so often the public wants an immediate decision on whether or not we are going to file charges in a particular case, that requires us to build strong and solid cases so that when we go before a jury, we know that we can prove our case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Predatory behavior towards vulnerable women like drug users or the mentally ill may be harder to prove. There's also an allegation from a woman in Portugal against Palmer, who claimed he became violent after she refused to have sex with him. No charges were filed, according to the California Post. The mounting accusations are leading to growing calls for Palmer to be removed from the sheriff's oversight board, including from Mayor Daniel Lurie, who's using Palmer's face to campaign for a ballot measure that would give the mayor's office greater power to remove people from public office. That's Proposition F, though critics say it's an attempted power grab. The supervisors could remove Palmer for actions unfit for office that fall below the standards of decency of a public official. But that has yet to happen. Supervisor Stephen Sherrill says he will push to remove Palmer in the coming weeks. KPFA reached out to Palmer and other sheriff's oversight board members for comment. None were returned by airtime. Palmer has openly sparred with a woman colleague on the commission. Julie Sue has reportedly called for his removal to no avail, but she was just voted in as the new sheriff's oversight board president. Palmer's profile on the sheriff's oversight board website says Palmer was arrested at 17 years of age for trying to rob and then kidnap an off-duty police officer. He was sentenced to life in prison. He was released after 31 years in 2019. The California Supreme Court ruled 23 of the years he was incarcerated were excessive punishment. The seat he holds at the San Francisco Sheriff's Oversight Board is meant for someone impacted by the carceral system. Supervisor Shimon Walton, whose legislation created the Sheriff's Oversight Board, has also called for Palmer's ouster. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
A judge in the Lindsey Clancy murder trial declared a mistrial today after jurors failed to reach a verdict in the case that sharply divided many Americans over whether the Massachusetts woman should be criminally responsible for killing her three young children. The trial has generated intense interest for more than a month, drawing attention to issues around maternal mental health after childbirth. Clancy, a former labor and delivery nurse, never disputed that she killed the children, but her attorney said she had a rare condition called postpartum psychosis when in 2023 she strangled her children, the youngest just 8 months old, then tried to take her own life. Prosecutors conceded that Clancy had severe mental illness, but insisted that she knew what she was doing. Clancy's lawyer, Kevin Reddington, said he hoped the case would open a broader conversation about the struggles postpartum women face.
I think, if anything, this case showed clearly and unequivocally the woeful deficiency that women have when they're pregnant, when they have babies, and God forbid, when they're on medication because of postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis. It is just horrible what we saw in this trial. And maybe things have to change. And I hope that, you know, this case gave it an opportunity to turn it around. Might be the spark that lights the fire.
Today's mistrial on the seventh day of deliberations leaves the case unresolved. In the end, the decision seemed to surprise no one in the courtroom. Neither Clancy nor her family showed any emotion as the judge announced the trial was ending without a resolution. Plymouth County District Attorney Timothy Cruz said there would not be an immediate decision about a second trial. A standoff continues between environmental activists and border wall builders in the southeastern portion of Arizona, while indigenous community members with the Tohono O'odham Nation to the west continue their prayer camp in opposition to the proposed wall on their land about 3 hours away. These stretches of border wall have been at the center of what tribal leaders, activists, and even a border wall county sheriff say is a politically motivated ploy by the Trump administration that wastes taxpayer money and does not make communities safer. And both the community of Locale, Arizona, and the Tohono O'odham Nation say it's not just the living paying the price. According to the on-the-ground reporting by KPFA's Lauren Schmidt, the Trump administration is moving full speed ahead on border wall construction along the Arizona-Mexico border, despite the government's own data showing the region has seen very little illegal crossing or smuggling. Nonetheless, the project moves ahead, and tribal leaders and environmental activists have established different camps roughly 100 miles apart, using different methods of protest, but with a similar goal: to preserve a sensitive natural ecosystem and respect the communities that have lived on these lands for hundreds and even thousands of years, all without a border wall. While the Tohono O'odham Nation says 3,000 tribal members will be cut off from their nation and lose access to life-saving services the tribe provides, it's not just current members facing the negative impacts. As construction moves forward, Chairman Verlin Jose says human remains have been unearthed and scattered across the cactus.
You know what our folks had to do? They had to go out there and collect pieces of bones that they saw out there. How would you like to go and pick pieces of your family up? How would you like it if I went to your cemeteries and I blew it up, and you had to go pick up the remains of your relatives, and they weren't whole? That is so sad and so disrespectful, and it's traumatizing.
Three sacred sites for the tribes have already been disturbed, desecrated, or destroyed, and others are still threatened, in addition to the human remains that now lay scattered across a landscape. The tribe has traditionally buried its dead where they died, according to Chairman Jose. Jose says he told DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen, the first Native American to hold the position, as well as CBP Commissioner Rodney Scott, who at the time, he says, were sympathetic to the tribal leaders' concerns. But he says the actions since then speak louder than words.
How many times have I heard your forked tongue? How many times has the U.S. government told us something and went against it? I don't have to tell you. History can tell you for itself on how many times they told us something and did the complete opposite of that.
But it's not just the 62-mile stretch of borderlands in the Tohono O'odham Nation that are threatened. If you head off the nation east towards Nogales, the wall construction resumes, but then ends in a small stretch roughly 100 miles away as the crow flies. There, hippies, punks, environmental activists, and other indigenous land protectors have taken to the woods in the high-elevation desert savanna to protect ancient trees and keep the parcel open for wildlife crossings. And while the preventing construction to protect wildlife is their main mission, they point to another impact of the border wall project. Border Patrol and its contractors have also damaged a private road, leading to an ancient cemetery containing the remains of both European and Mexican settlers. The damage has been so extensive, they say, they can no longer access the cemetery by vehicle, something Schmidt was able to corroborate firsthand when they visited the site. Schmidt said they hiked up to the private cemetery where a once smooth road had been carved up and rerouted. And according to the private property owner, contractors are illegally using the road for construction. The road has been graded to the point that it is now undrivable, with new water banks and unnatural mounds cut into the landscape. Heavy equipment and sections of the metal border wall have also been staged along the road, completely blocking vehicle access to the cemetery. Schmidt hiked up to with a land protector who asked to only use their nickname, Hoops.
Before these panels were here, they still had destroyed the road, so it would be, this is where you can enter to get to the cemetery. But as you can see, it's completely impossible to drive. Even if these panels were not here, this is still inaccessible by car. So, we go. Look at that. That's shameful. It's shameful to block a family from being able to visit their loved one.
The family would post a sign before the construction began, reading, quote, "We honor our dead. Keep Cemetery Road drivable." Those wishes would not be recognized and would actually be in violation of an Arizona statute, but the breaking of laws by federal officials has actually been a growing concern by the Santa Cruz County Sheriff, whose district these actions are in, and who says his family were settlers in this small town, that they have existed without a border. He would go on to say that he has witnessed federal agents lie about the goings-on of protesters.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's the origins of my family in Arizona, is the town of Lokiel. There are two graveyards in Lokiel. One is for my family and one is for the De La Osa family.
That was Sheriff David Hathaway. The De La Osa family owns the property where the cemetery is located. A graveyard, Schmidt corroborated, is no longer accessible by vehicle because of border construction. Sheriff Hathaway is one of four border county sheriffs in the state of Arizona.
And I'm in Santa Cruz County. I'm the chief law enforcement officer for Santa Cruz County, which also is the county that has the largest ports of entry with Mexico. We have, a passenger vehicle port of entry, a commercial port of entry, three different pedestrian ports of entry, a railroad port of entry, even a livestock port of entry where they actually open the fence and cattle come in and out.
The sheriff explained that he doesn't look like the majority of his community, which is 95% Hispanic.
Now, some people would incorrectly talk about an invasion and things like that. But you know what's funny is the demographics, if you go back 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, the demographics are exactly the same as they always have been.
Sheriff Hathaway acknowledges that the land now known as Arizona was once part of Mexico and before that, Spain. He expressed deep concern about the rhetoric coming from politicians who aren't on the border. Politicians, he says, are trying to gain political points with xenophobic rhetoric by preying on people's fears. But Hathaway said those fears are unfounded, and the data backs him up, showing his community is among the safest in the state.
My crime rates in my county, right on the border, are lower than the average for Arizona. They're lower than the big cities like Tucson and Phoenix. It's a very safe place. Our crime rates are very low. But people, unfortunately, at the national level, the political level, they like to do this rhetoric to try to scare everybody into thinking that people from another place are dangerous. It's just classic xenophobia. Governments have been doing this for thousands of years, trying to get you scared of the guy that lives on the other side of the hill, like he's out to kill you and take all your stuff. It's just not true, and human beings are the same everywhere.
Sheriff Hathaway is not like his neighboring counterparts, all of whom have openly embraced militarization at the border and have even sent resources to police protesters, despite those protests taking place in Hathaway's county, not their own.
And we do have a group of protesters out there, and I've gone and stood in unison with the protesters that are now there's this stand of cottonwood trees that are 200-year-old trees, like massive trees that are some of them have been bulldozed down, and the intent is to bulldoze the rest of them down. So we have a combination of, you know, human rights activists, environmental activists, wildlife advocates from like the Jaguar Coalition. That this is the only place in the U.S. where jaguars still come up from Mexico and migrate into the U.S., but this new wall has no provision for them to be able to cross through their, you know, traditional lands that they have roamed for eons. So it's a shame that that's happening. There's no need for it. And I think the Trump administration is just trying to spend money like crazy. They've had tens of billions of dollars appropriated to build this wall, and they want to get it done. This is my opinion, a little bit of politics, before the November general election, because I think Trump's party is likely to lose control of the House of Representatives, and some of this may be undone. So they're doing it as crazy fast as they can.
According to protesters, Customs and Border Protection officers have called 911 so many times that they say the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office began treating the calls as a case of crying wolf and refused to spend taxpayer dollars responding to what they considered unfounded calls for service.
Yes, that's exactly true. And it's been laughable, the kind of things they do, because as you described, Lauren, those people, very peaceful people, you know, just think Woodstock, throwback to the hippie era, countercultural revolution, the Vietnam War protesters. That's what they're like. These are very peaceful people. But the CBP and the contracting company that's getting billions of dollars to build this wall will continually call 911 and say crazy things like, "We've been kidnapped." It's like, wait a minute, what do you mean you've been kidnapped? Well, we don't feel free to leave. What do you mean you don't feel free to leave? Well, these people are sitting in the trees and kind of blocking our bulldozers from knocking down the trees. And it's like, okay, that's, and so we can't proceed to knock down the trees. So they call that kidnapping. So we laugh that one off. Do you expect us to be your little Gestapo KGB stooges that go along with your bulldozers and just like throw everybody out of the way?
KPFA Radio has understood the importance of this story, one that spans tribal nations and international borders, which is why we sent our news director, Lauren Schmidt, to report from the ground. With ground truthing too often lacking in national media coverage, we believe that as Pacifica, it is our duty to get to the bottom of the truth and listen to the people at the center of this movement, an ethos Sheriff Hathaway himself thanked us for.
I really appreciate that, because there's so much sensationalism at the national level related to borders and immigration, and very little truth on that subject. You know, for example, the statistics are wildly skewed. They will claim that people, you know, immigrants, migrants are coming here to commit crimes, to murder, to rape, to plunder, to steal. That's Donald Trump's own words, but the truth couldn't be farther from that.
KPFA News, Lauren Schmidt has been on the ground all week along the border at the tree sit where activists gathered beneath the tree as a forest defender remained suspended 40 feet in the air, on the Tohono O'odham Nation where indigenous leaders have established a prayer camp, to Nogales, Arizona where elders remember a time before the border, and to Nogales, Mexico where they say the same. One community divided by a border they never asked for. We'll bring you more on that story in a special report on Labor Day. The company behind Tetris is pushing back after the White House launched a browser arcade featuring a game clearly inspired by the puzzle classic. The arcade, released yesterday, includes five retro-style games thematically tied to President Trump's political agenda. One called Build the Wall is a Tetris clone that has players stack falling blocks to defend the border during a, quote, zombie border siege. The Tetris company responded on social media, posting an image that said, quote, "At Tetris, we believe in the power of connection and bringing people together, not dividing them. To our fans everywhere, we love you, we see you, and we're grateful to have you in our community." In text accompanying the image, the company added, quote, "P.S. The Tetris company was not involved in the creation of Build the Wall. PPS, we take copyright infringement very seriously. The dispute follows similar clashes, including Japan warning the U.S. government over its use of Nintendo and Pokemon imagery in political memes. Bay Area weather this evening, mostly clear before becoming mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s. Mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny, hot.
Support for KPFK comes in part from C Sharp Entertainment, presenting El Dimeola live in concert, the Guitarchitect Tour, live at the Alex Theater, Saturday, September 19th, 2020.